Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and the political commentator and humorist PJ O'Rourke is here. I'm not sure if I can actually say his new book title on the air.
Actually, yeah, I know. The FCC, we'll find out, won't we?
We've checked with teams of lawyers and constitutional experts, and they say it's okay to say don't vote, it just encourages the bastards, which is the title of PJ O'Rourke's latest book, which is kind of a whirlwind tour through the current political climate here in the United States. And while that may be a relatively cynical title, the book provides a more nuanced assessment of the state of our democracy, from the financial bailouts to the stimulus to health care and other examples of what O'Rourke sees as growing government excess and inefficiency. If nothing else, you know P.J. O'Rourke from his panelist stint on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, but he's also the H.L. Mencken Research Fellow at the Cato Institute and author of 16 books, of which Don't Vote, It Just Encourages the Bastards, there I said it again, is the latest. It's out now from the Atlantic Monthly Press. P.J., welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. Thank you. I think it's all right to use the word bastards as long as you're using it as an actual descriptive term. We're not just cursing.
This has to do with who they're... parents are? Is that...
Metaphorically speaking.
Do you have a quick reaction to the Facebook education story that we just discussed? You have a libertarian streak, it's certainly fair to say. Is private money the answer to our public education woes?
No, actually, I don't think it is. The thing that shocks me about our public education is actually the per pupil spending. And this was something that kind of came out of me. I have a brief mention of it in the book. I did a longer piece for the Weekly Standard about it. I was just sitting around, you know, putting off work, and the school budget for I live in rural New Hampshire. We have a nice little school district, good schools. We've got only about 5,000 kids in the whole school district, K through 12. And I looked at the budget figure. It was $43 million and some. I thought, wait a minute. Took out the calculator. It was $13,500 per kid. Now, there have been a lot of complaints about our school system, much as many other. I mean, we don't have the kind of waiting for Superman problems that New York does, but we have our problems. The kids aren't coming out. They're coming out only a little smarter than they went in, and we want them to come out a lot smarter. And they're sneaking out in the parking lot and smoking dope and all the rest of the things that kids do. And I thought $13,500 per kid. And again, I did a little math. And that turns out to be adjusted for inflation, about twice what it cost me to go to college in the 1960s.
In the 1960s, we
no,
should
no,
point
no,
out.
But adjusted for inflation.
Oh, adjusted for inflation.
Oh no, it cost me $600 a semester to my tuition. It cost me about
right. Well, private colleges now are $50,000.
Oh well, unbelievable, and we're hoping those kids are coming out a little smarter than they go in. And I was thinking, well, okay, let's take these kids. I looked in the school budget; they get 15, the student teacher ratio is 1 to 15. Let's gather these kids together in groups of 15, and we could pay $200,000 a year for their teacher. We could hire Aristotle. Okay, now, where do we teach these kids? Well, what's it matter? Teach them in your living room. We can cut a little of that $200,000 for carpet cleanup and so on. Teach them at the Moose Hall. Teach them at, I don't know if I dare say this, teach them at the church. You know, it's only used one day a week. Teach them at the town library. Take 15 kids, pay the teacher $200,000 a year. You could get, and I said, no, they wouldn't have band practice, but they'd have Aristotle.
Right, I get you. But it also shows that maybe some of the same people who are complaining that money is not the source of fixing the problems in the urban schools, when they themselves have enough money and move to nice places like rural New Hampshire, will vote themselves really high property taxes in order to dump tons and tons of money into their own kids' education, seeming to make the argument that they think money is a key to success in public
obviously
education.
Money's important. There's no doubt about it. But I would argue that we have evidence that we are spending enough money, that there's got to be some other problems out there. District of Columbia schools, one of the reasons we left the District of Columbia and moved full-time to New Hampshire was because of schools. The District of Columbia public schools are dreadful. I mean, everyone accepts that. Their per student spending is well over $20,000 per kid per year. So all we really know from this is it's not just money.
One of the best lines in your book, I think, is we don't vote to elect great persons to office. We vote to throw the bastards out. And now that the midterm primaries are over and we have candidates like Christine O'Donnell of Delaware, who dabbled in witchcraft and led an anti-masturbation campaign. This used to be a family show. Do you care?
I know what happened. We degenerated so quickly.
Do you care to amend that statement? After all, if we vote to throw the bastards out, sometimes we end up voting the crazy person in.
Well, I guess in order to throw the bastards out, we got to vote them in first. I think, that really my point is that democracy has at least the potential of being self-correcting in a way autocracy or dictatorship does not. The throw the bastards out, and of course, you know, the baby does get thrown out with the bathwater sometime. There's no doubt about that. But this is the thing that Zimbabweans cannot do with Robert Mugabe. This is what the Chinese cannot do. What it would seem pretty clearly that the Russians can't do, certainly what the people in Kazakhstan and so all the really naughty places, North Korea, what they can't do is get rid of their political leadership. And I have no particular faith that replacing lousy political leadership is going to lead to wonderful political leadership.
We're doing a series on our politics website. It's freecountry.org. Called Wonk Wars, where each week we're inviting policy experts and listeners and others to come online and discuss a particular true-false statement. And this week's proposition is true or false, the Tea Party has been good for America. Do you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I absolutely agree that it's been good for America. It's good for – much as I dislike politics, and I really do. I've been covering politics in one way or another for 40 years, and I'm just – and I hate it. I guess there's no way around it. And I think that politics should have a limited place in life. I mean, if we just think about even our wonderful democratic politics, and I'm not against democracy by any means, but imagine if everything were submitted to a vote. Imagine if dinner were decided by a family secret ballot. I have three children, three dogs. We would be having rotten meat and Fruit Loops for dinner, you know. Imagine if your clothes were selected by the majority of shoppers, which would be teenage girls, you know. I'd be walking around today with Juicy across my behind. You know? I mean, not everything belongs in the political sphere. Nonetheless, political involvement in a democracy, we are the government in a democracy. Political involvement is very important. Tea Party has definitely increased political involvement, not only among Tea Party members, but among people who oppose the Tea Party members. It's been a general stimulus. The other thing I really like about the Tea Party is that the Tea Party is acutely aware of what we might call positive rights. You know, in political science, there are two kinds of rights. I think Isaiah Berlin was the inventor of this concept. Negative rights are rights that protect us. Freedom of speech, freedom of religion. Really, the whole Bill of Rights is about negative rights. Negative rights are not zero sum. They don't have to do with anything that there's a limited amount of. There's no end of talk, as anyone who's turned on talk radio knows. And my talking doesn't keep somebody else from talking. My believing, my being a Catholic doesn't keep somebody from being Jewish, and so on and so forth. Positive rights have to do with my right to a given thing. I have a right to housing. I have a right to medical care. I have a right to education. Well, now we're talking about material objects of which there is a fixed amount, at least in theory. And so at least also in theory, at least, what I take is something that you lose. There's only a certain amount of this. I eat too many slices of the pizza, and you have to eat the Domino's box. The Tea Party is acutely aware of the problem of expansion of positive rights. It's also very rare for a populist movement in America to be interested in contracting positive rights. Now, some Tea Party members may be hypocritical about this, contract all sorts of positive rights except for my Medicare, except for my Social Security, or so on. But nonetheless, they are coming out and saying we need to contract the scope of positive rights being granted. Otherwise, we're just going to be overrun with government and politics. And I was actually saying that. I was giving a talk somewhere and a Q&A, and somebody asked me about the Tea Party, and I said, well, I said, you know, show me the rural agrarian populist movement of the 19th century wanted cheaper interest rates, free coinage of silver. The progressives of the early 20th century wanted all sorts of city planning and parks and this and that and the other thing. Even the civil rights movement wanted positive rights in the sense that they wanted the government to get out there and enforce the law. It's not an insult to say that populist movements want an increase in populist rights, sometimes in positive rights. Sometimes they're right, but show me another populist movement that that has been interested in contracting positive rights. And somebody at the back of the room yelled, "The Whiskey Rebellion."
Yeah, less education, less health care,
and more whiskey.
So, well, I'm curious then with this historical context that you just gave, and I think you would call yourself a libertarian generally.
Generally speaking, yeah. Small L. Yeah.
Would you say that there are things that make the Tea Party movement different from the libertarian movement that has existed for decades in this country? Because we were, you know, this show certainly has hosted no shortage of libertarians in recent years, and that was before anybody called themselves a Tea Partier.
Well, libertarian philosophy is fairly well worked out, fairly established philosophy with a sort of set of premises and a lot of logical deductions from those premises. In fact, if anything, the besetting sin of libertarianism tends to be an over-rationalization about – it's a ratiocination about things, attempting to apply reason everywhere, even, you know, to the parts of life that are thoroughly unreasonable. The Tea Party movement is more of a first place, it's very hard to generalize about it because it is very scattered. I did a piece for World Affairs, foreign policy magazine in Washington, about Tea Party foreign policy.
Yeah, you asked Tea Partiers in New Hampshire.
In New Hampshire.
What their Tea Party foreign policy would be,
and,
right?
And it was a twofold problem because there is no Tea Party foreign policy. And then upon close inspection, it turned out there wasn't any Tea Party either. So it's hard to generalize about the Tea Party, but I think if I must, I would say that this is a sort of incoherent and not as yet terribly well articulated general feeling that the expanse, the sheer expanse of politics, measured in money or measured in power over our daily lives, has gotten a bit out of hand and is certainly something that the people who started the United States would be a little surprised to see.
Well, as exemplified by Ron Paul, there may be, if enough Tea Partiers get elected this fall, a new peace movement Tea Party coalition to get the United States out of Afghanistan or some such thing.
On the other hand, if another Tea Party favorite, Sarah Palin, were to become the main influence, you might find an even more aggressive U.S. foreign policy.
As somebody who does humor grounded in political conviction, I wonder if you have an opinion of Jon Stewart's and Stephen Colbert's upcoming rally to restore sanity, as Stewart calls it, rally to increase fear or something to that effect that Colbert is calling it.
I don't know. You know, I thought that the Colbert testimony in front of Congress was one of, I mean, as if Congress didn't have enough clowns. I mean, I thought this was a terrible case of Coles to Newcastle. I like Jon Stewart a lot because Jon does his homework. Jon's humor about politics is kindred to mine, although he and I have very different politics, in that it's based on observation. It's reported. I mean, we do a kind of a funny version of the reported essay. I mean, we tend to try and actually look at things. Colbert's is something I got to say I don't quite understand. I mean, it was sort of funny once, but honestly, there are people you can tune into on talk radio and indeed on television who are a good deal funnier than Colbert, and they mean it.
And they mean it. He's mocking the conservative talk show
and
host.
Then the other thing, as I say, is I know enough fake conservatives already. I mean, I covered Washington for a long time. I know plenty of fake conservatives.
Well, I guess Stewart's rally to restore sanity. Sanity is a perilous position for a humorist to take. We'll see how long he can
actually
keep sanity.
We shouldn't be
funny.
In favor of this. You know, I think that I think
bad for business.
It's bad for business. I think he's biting the hand that feeds him.
We have 30 seconds left. One quick question. Who's the funniest panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me? If you had to hang out with only one of the people on the show, Peter Sagal, Roxanne Roberts, Mo Rocca, Paula Poundstone, who's your desert island co-panelist on Wait, Wait?
Well, that's kind of two different questions all at once. The funniest person, though, is Paula Poundstone. There's just absolutely no doubt about it. Paula is just... has a funny worldview. Paula cannot stop herself. She's
not
wonderful.
Afraid to take a position on the funniest person on Wait, Wait,
I'm
Don't
not,
Tell
I'm
Me.
I'm not.
PJ O'Rourke. His new book is called Don't Vote. It just encourages the bastards. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.